You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex Toku Ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producers Flo and Liam. E whai ake nei, coming up on the show, for Dear Science this week, our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, speaks with us about going to the moon, graphene and alchemy. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about the government surcharge ban, the new police amendment, and the continued fuel crisis. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi, I spoke to James Russell, Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, about updates to the predator-free 2050 strategy, including further funding to make Wellington a predator-free city within the next 10 years.
And Flo, what have you got for us today?
Kia ora, Alex. I spoke to Chris Bullen, Professor of Public Health at the School of Population Health of the University of Auckland, about his criticism of the recent RNZ investigation into illicit tobacco and his research-based rejection of the investigation's findings.
We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e āhei ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēnei kōrero āno. Hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these shows and more by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakatūranga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we are joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. How are we, Alan?
I always get worried when you call me an expert, but yeah.
What have you got for us today?
Right, okay, we're going to the moon.
Oh, fun.
And we just don't know when, that's the thing. So this is a bit weird, actually. So there is a mission planned to the moon, to actually fly around the moon. And the last time that humanity went to the moon was 1972. And It's not a long time ago at all, Alex. In fact, you know, this is where I give away my age and say I can remember Neil Armstrong. So that was 1972, and that was the last time that a human stood on the moon, and that human was Gene Cernan. And that was part of the Apollo missions, which were Apollo 11 to 17, which were all tasked with putting people on the moon, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, Apollo 13 was the famous exception in all of that because they had a little accident on the way there, and as a result of that, what they had to do to get back was to perfectly time a slingshot around the back of the moon and then use the moon's gravity to basically fling them back towards Earth. And this was all very, very, had to be absolutely precisely timed and everything back in the days of, you know, very, very rudimentary computers. They managed to do it. When they were around the back of the moon, they were, in fact, 254 kilometres above the surface of the back of the moon, which put them almost exactly 400,000 kilometres away from Earth, and that is the furthest that humanity has been away from our planet.
Oh.
Until maybe tomorrow. We just don't know yet, okay? So there is now the Artemis missions, and Artemis was Apollo's twin sister, apparently. From Greek mythology, goddess of the hunt and childbirth, so I'm told. So this is the Artemis II spacecraft, and apparently it's all set to go on April the 1st, apparently, which is not a very auspicious day, I wouldn't have thought. but this is Artemis II, and this is going to contain four astronauts, And they are going to go 8,000 kilometres beyond the backside of the moon. And so that is going to be the furthest that humanity has been away. Hopefully they're going to come back. That's the point. And they will, all going well, splash down in the Pacific, just like the Apollo missions used to do with the big parachutes and everything like that. And splash down in the Pacific, get picked up. And that's going to take 10 days in total. So this is a big mission. And really, I haven't heard a heck of a lot of this in the media. There's not been a massive build-up to this at all. You know, this is huge stuff. This is massive, and they're doing it to prepare for a planned lunar landing in 2028. And, you know, people ask, well, we've already been there, why are we doing it again? Well, you know, it's science. We know more, way, way, way more than we did 50 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. And so all going well with this, then they're going to have Artemis 3 next year, and that's going to be sort of in a low Earth orbit. And what they are going to be doing, and you wouldn't credit it, they need a landing vehicle to get onto the moon from the vehicle that's going to be orbiting the moon. And, of course, who's making those landing vehicles? Who is in competition to make the landing vehicles? Of course, Elon bloody Musk and Jeff bloody Bezos, aren't they? Okay, so that's going to be Artemis 3 next year. And they're going to trial out which one of those is going to go better. And then, again, all going well, Artemis 4 in 2028 is going to be the big one. So these four astronauts, my goodness, I can remember sort of growing up and thinking, my, wouldn't it be amazing to be an astronaut? Well, they're going to be sitting on basically in a massive canister of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And this spacecraft has only flown once before. I've just got to say, they are way braver than I would ever,
terrifying.
Be. The propellant, you know, is it's just ridiculous. But you know, this is what gives you the thrust that enables you to get out of the Earth's gravitational influence and, you know, get on the way to the moon. So that, and the solid rocket boosters as well, that they've got to give you a bit of thrust as well, a thing called ammonium perchlorate, which... nasty stuff. I've used that in the lab. And a mixture of that and aluminium, big, big oxidizing reaction. And it's going to be incredible to see it go. So, you know, this could be the start of a whole new series of manned spaceflight. We'll see what happens. But, you know, are we going to have a permanent base on the moon? Is that going to be the next step? Are they going to go to Mars? Is that the next step? You know, there's all sorts of questions that need to be answered. And, you know, how we sort of stand up to long periods in space. They've certainly done it on the space station, but that's only just above the Earth. And, you know, only 30 minutes away by car, as somebody once said. God, space is not far away. It's only 30 minutes away by car, which is a great quote. And it's absolutely true. But we'll see how this goes. So, you know, it's going to be another chapter in humanity's delving into space, I guess. So,
exciting.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
Big.
Yes.
I can't wait to say that I've seen a moon landing. Hopefully.
Yeah,
if all goes well.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
But what do we have next?
Graphene.
I don't know.
Well, graphene oxide, in fact. So, right. What do we know about carbon, folks?
Less than I should. It's in a lot of things.
It is in a lot of... Oh, hell yes, it is. Absolutely. So carbon can exist in two main forms, as I was explaining to my first year students the other day. One form is diamond, okay?
Classic.
And it's that beautiful, you know, gorgeous, amazing form of carbon. And the other form of carbon is... Oh, we do have a pencil right here. Look at that. There, that's the other form of carbon right there. That is graphite.
My beloved graphite.
Okay. And that is the lead in pencil. It's not lead, it's actually graphite. Now, if you take graphite and you put sticky tape on it, take a sheet of graphite, put sticky tape on it, and then pull off the sticky tape really, really, really quite gently, you win yourself a Nobel Prize in physics. I kid you not. Because this is what two researchers did in Manchester in 2004. They took a sheet of graphite, they put some sticky tape on it, they lifted the sticky tape off, and what they got was one layer of graphite stuck to the sticky tape. And this is called graphene, okay? And graphene is ridiculously unusual. Okay, it looks like chicken wire. So you all know what chicken wire looks like, a bunch of hexagons all together. It's exactly what graphene looks like, and it goes off to infinity in one, or well, in two dimensions, I guess. And they won a Nobel Prize for this because of the fact that graphene has got such amazing properties. So it is seriously strong. You take a square meter of graphene, okay, it will support, and God knows why they use this as the example, a 4 kilogram cat. But the layer of graphene, the 1 square meter of graphene, will weigh as much as one of the cat's whiskers.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
not a lot.
So it's incredibly strong. It's one of the strongest materials that's ever been tested, apparently, okay? So it's got all sorts of really interesting properties, really interesting electronic properties, really interesting optical properties. But we're not here to talk about graphene. We're here to talk about a derivative of graphene called graphene oxide. And that's what happens when you take graphene and essentially you put oxygen atoms all over the surface of it. And then it gets other weird and wonderful properties. And some workers in Korea have just shown that graphene oxide is a really, really, really good antibacterial agent. And the beauty about this is that it can act as an antibacterial agent, but it can leave human cells untouched. Okay, so it's very, very specific for these bacteria. And the reason that they think it's specific for these bacteria, as they've just found out, is that it interacts specifically with particular molecules that are in the cell walls of the bacteria that we don't have in our cell walls, okay? So it's picking out these things specifically, and they've just pretty much got very, very lucky with this and found that, yep, this is going to kill those bacteria. It's going to leave us untouched. And so therefore, it's got myriads of applications. So it's already, they've gotten to the commercial field with this already. The beauty of this is they can make fibers of this material. They can wash it and repeated washing and everything, and it doesn't lose its antibacterial properties, which is, you know, absolutely brilliant. And in fact, the first commercial material, if you want, that they've made is an antibacterial toothbrush.
Oh.
And so this is sold over 10 million, apparently, over in Korea. And so very, very cool. And you know, potentially a really powerful weapon against bacteria that, you know, humanity certainly needs.
I would not mind an antibacterial toothbrush.
Well, keep an eye out for them. Go on, I don't know, Timu or somewhere like that. It'll be there, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll see. Anything can happen.
Yeah. Beware of cheap imitations, I guess, yeah. So.
And what do we have last?
And last we're going to talk alchemy. Alchemy,
fun.
Alchemy.
Hell yeah.
Alchemy was what the old quote-unquote scientists were trying to do. So the purpose of alchemy was turning lead into gold, as I'm sure you are all very aware. And funnily enough, they never actually succeeded despite literally thousands of years of trying. And one of the great things that actually happened as a result of alchemy was that chemistry itself was born. And this was a guy by the name of Hennig Brunt in 1669, and he thought, what looks like gold that I could probably turn into gold? I know, urine. And so he got about, I think it was about 4,000 litres of urine downstairs, and he started boiling this off, so lit a fire underneath it, boiling off the liquid, and eventually ended up with this sort of waxy white solid that glowed in the dark and would burst spontaneously into flames if you put it into air. And that was phosphorus. And so that was the first element that we know exactly the date of discovery for.
Oh.
Okay. So all the others, like your sulfurs and your carbons and all of those sorts of things, they were known to the ancients, but we don't know when they were discovered per se. But so phosphorus was the first one that we know the date for, and that was really the start of modern chemistry. So something sort of good came out of alchemy, okay, but they never did manage to turn lead into gold. Now we've got this thing called the Large Hadron Collider over in Switzerland, and they have actually managed it. They have managed to turn lead into gold, believe it or not. And you're thinking, whoa, here we go. Let's make a fortune. Well, let's not, because they've made 24 trillionths of a gram of gold from lead, which really is not going to justify the cost of the whole Large Hadron Collider, really. It's not going to pay for itself like that. No, no. So what do they do here? So if you're going to turn lead into gold, what you've got to do is to get into the nucleus of a lead atom, which contains protons and neutrons, and you've got to pick out three protons, and that will turn your lead atom into gold, okay?
Of course.
But that's difficult. That is not easy, because the nucleus has this thing called the strong nuclear force that holds it all together, and it's got to be really, really, really strong, because you've got all these protons stuck together, and they've all got positive charges, and normally they'll repel each other. But you get them close enough, and the strong nuclear force takes over, and that holds them in with incredible strength, absolutely, you know, mind-boggling strength. So how do you then pick three protons out of that lead nucleus to make gold? Well, what you do is you take a beam of lead atoms going in one direction, and you fire another beam of lead atoms at it in the opposite direction, and you just miss. Okay, and these beams of lead atoms are traveling round about the speed of light, so they're going pretty quickly. And so you aim it just almost perfectly, not perfectly, but almost perfectly, so that they just sort of slide past each other. And as they just miss each other, you get this massive, massive, massive electric field set up between the two nuclei that are just passing by each other. And that seemingly is remarkably strong enough to pull protons out of the nuclei of the lead, and that turns that into gold, which I find absolutely astonishing given the strength of the interactions in the nucleus, that doing something like this could pull protons out of the nucleus. But then again, you're approaching each other at the speed of light, so you know, anything can happen. We're talking high energy here, we're talking extraordinarily high energy. And what they don't actually see are the gold atoms that are produced. So they can't actually see those, but they can infer the fact that they have made them through analysis of the beam of lead atoms after they've passed each other, and their decreasing intensity and stuff like that. And not only do they rip out three protons, they can also rip out one proton to form thallium, which is a nasty poisonous beastie, or two protons to form mercury, which is also a nasty poisonous beastie as well.
Three nasty poisonous beasties and gold.
So, yes, in fact, you can turn lead into gold, but not in an economic sense, shall we say.
Hey, but they were onto something.
Oh, yeah, no. Hey, this is all science. You know, this is good stuff. So, yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of nice.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you so much, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Journey into Motet on Sunday, 19th April, and spend the day amongst the grass, soil, and garden with Live Day Farming.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School. Checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday, only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Mark William Lewis and his Foggy London Tunes are heading over to the isthmus we call home. And lucky for B-card holders, we have tickets to give away to a show. So keep that dial on 95 BFM Drive for your chance to win. Mark William Lewis album release tour at Double Whammy April 6th. Tickets available now at eventfighter.co.nz.
to see if your back was still aligned and your sheets were growing grass all on the corners of your bed. But you've got too much to wear on your sleeves. It has too much to do with me. And secretly, I want to bury in the yard the gray remains of a friendship scar. Skin and petals are kissing the lipless, the bleed off the sweetness away.
That was Kissing the Lipless by The Shins. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last year, the government moved to ban surcharges on contactless purchases, aiming to stop customers from being punished for their payment option of choice. However, last week, the ACT Party announced they would not support the bill, calling it bad economics. Last week also saw the government begin to push for the Police Amendment Bill, which seeks to, according to the government, reinstate police powers around filming and recording, as well as granting and changing other powers. Of course, the fuel crisis is still hitting New Zealand, with the government introducing a new fuel rationing plan, with the government attempting to maintain a sense of calm amidst a situation that continues to develop. This week, I spoke with National Party MP Ryan Hamilton about each of these topics, beginning with the state of the surcharge ban. Last year, the National Party introduced legislation that sought to ban in-store surcharges, decrying the annoyance to the shopper of being penalised based on which payment method they chose. Can you just walk us through the government's logic behind this move?
So I think a lot of people can resonate with, you walk into a dairy or a shop and you've got a note on the EFTPOS machine, you know, saying, you know, surcharge and may apply, and you kind of go, yeah, whatever. But I think because every place has such a variation, some have, you know, 1.2, some have 2.3, and there's no, I guess, there's no sort of rhyme or reason from the consumer interface. You just, you know, very high trust model. You pay for the convenience of using a tap and go type payment system. Whereas in other places like the supermarket, you don't experience it. So as part of the Commerce Commission review of surcharges last year, there was some discovery that some merchants were overcharging and obviously disguising the opportunity to put a bit more profit in with that surcharge. That's not for everyone, of course, but that sort of was part of it. But also they felt that the surcharges were too high, and with the changes that they implemented in December of last year, that it would actually reduce the surcharge payment by around 50%, which was, you know, quite a significant drop. And so at the time, we were thinking that was a perfect time to clean up or sanitise that interface with the customer, because the margin that the merchant would be incurring would be, you know, literally cut in half. But yeah, since then, so we haven't had the data come through yet from that Commerce Commission change. So it'd be really fascinating to see how that flow through has now started to take place. And so the minister wanted to sort of analyse that before making next steps. But obviously it was a bit noisy, and different parties, you know, sort of postured and took different views, because a lot of shopkeepers felt that then they were going to absorb that surcharge and that it was an unfair burden on them. Whereas other customers like the idea of, you know, a clean interface, because it's just one, the price of the till is the price you pay. So there's a lot of mixed views around the table. Ultimately, we're just trying to make the experience as frictionless as possible for the consumer. And we're doing a lot of other stuff in the banking sort of ecosystem, if you like, around open banking and fintechs and things. But where this has got to is we're just trying to work through how we can advance this system in a way which is going to get the most buy-in across government, but also from a retailer's association perspective as well.
Right, yeah, you've signalled to it there a little bit, but particularly the ACT Party has kind of looked at this legislation and called it bad economics. What is the National Party's response to this, and is there what is the sense of actually progressing this bill without the support of a coalition partner?
Well, you might have seen last week there was, you know, the minister in charge is also talking to Labor as well. We are trying to find as much bipartisan, you know, pathway through this as well, because I think, you know, we don't want, no politician wants business owners to be paying or absorbing more costs than they need to, especially in, you know, the challenging times we're in. But we also want to make the experience as consistent as possible for all Kiwis, you know, across the payments ecosystem. So, sure, there's a lot of conversations at the moment, and there'll be a little bit of posturing from other parties, but, you know, we're hopeful that we can find a way through all this.
Turning elsewhere, the government has also moved last week to push through legislation giving the police new powers. Can you explain the rationale behind this new legislation?
Yeah, sure. The bill is it's being passed to respond to a court ruling that essentially restricted the police's ability to record images and sound in public places. But by allowing the appropriate use of some recording or images in those places, and sometimes private, it's actually quite useful for crime prevention and intelligence gathering and other functions of the police. Because at the moment it's sort of almost like a black spot in terms of the police's arsenal to be able to use material or, you know, visual recording, which they know could be helpful in clarifying guilt in a case. But at the moment, that restriction, you know, the restriction limits them. So this is just an appropriate way to expand those powers to basically help keep Kiwi safe and hold offenders accountable. There's also a few other, because it's an amendment bill, there's a few other things in that bill as well, including extending police's ability to set up temporary road closure powers around parks, reserve beaches and car parks. And that can help, you know, stop vehicles that might be, you know, suspicious, and also obtain identifying particulars for the use of infringement and arrest without warrant those who fail to comply. So it sort of seeks to amend a few, I guess it's, I wouldn't say it's an omnibus bill, but it's more of a holistic a bill that tidies up a few of those and opens up a few of those aspects.
The legislation has seen criticism, though, from the Privacy Commissioner about the bar being set too low, and with experts expressing concerns over police discretion, with the opposition mirroring the same arguments. What defence does the government have for the concerns that the bar is here is set too low for the police potentially overriding people's privacy?
Well, that's always a tension point. I think I'm just trying to work out. I can't work out whether that bill's whether it's gone through select committee or not, because obviously that would be the appropriate mechanism for Privacy Commission and opposition to it to be fleshed out. I think the bill's been introduced, but it might be being passed this week. So yeah, I couldn't comment on that specifically. But if it is being passed, then that select committee process would have had the opportunity to have that input and obviously, make any appropriate amendments that might be required.
But kind of looking at the rationale behind the move, at least, what does the government kind of acknowledge the fact that obviously people are likely to be a little bit up in arms about the idea of the police having more powers to record them?
Yeah, but I guess it comes back to that balance, right? Because there might be a feeling of big brother, but then there's also when something goes, bad, or someone's daughter gets assaulted, and there's image that can actually verify the perpetrators and hold them to account, I think people very quickly understand that it's used in an appropriate place. It's not like it's going to be a publicly available source of, visual images. It's, those things are used with pretty strict protocols around the police. Everything the police do is subject to independent police complaints authority. It gets audited, and the police have already had quite a lot of challenging press in the last wee while. So those aren't the sorts of things that are taken for granted.
So is there a commitment then from the government to make sure that the safeguards around police discretion and how these powers will be used remain safe and fair?
Yeah, I think that's implicit with anything we do with police. I mean, they have very strict protocols and processes, so, those processes are implicit, and there's also checks and balances along the way as well. We've also been progressing the antisocial road use legislation bill, which will give more clarity and consistency for police with boy racers or antisocial street users as well, with higher infringements and the ability to destroy vehicles as well, which is there's a reasonable threshold to do that, but we're certainly sending a clear message that sort of behaviour is really high risk. When convoys of 200 plus cars block roads, and especially in rural areas, and Fonterra milk trucks can't get through, or in one case got violently attacked, there's just a bit of a rebalancing this government's really focused on and upping the ability for police to act and protect and keep our community safe.
And finally, last week the government announced a fuel rationing plan for dealing with the ongoing crisis. Can you just quickly walk us through what this plan entails?
Sure. So the New Zealand fuel response has been broken into four phases, which essentially sort of steps through the process as the fuel crisis might, potentially get worse. And so the first one, phase one, is essentially called watchful, where the government's monitoring stocks and shipments, publishing weekly stock updates. And in terms of the public, they continue business as per usual, but they're saying check out ECA's information on fuel saving measures. But if the market the fuel market continues to escalate, then they'll move into phase two, which is a precautionary approach. And obviously the government's processes ramp up. Where they'll implement a public sector fuel response plan. At that point, the community is still able to access fuel as they normally would, but obviously with a bit more, consideration perhaps given to combining trips or other modes of transport. And then it goes on to phase three and phase four. Both those are still currently under consultation. But under phase three, there's a banned approach where the government has essentially stepped out initially general retail sales to consumers, then it might have to claw back, then it's just allowing commercial use, and then it'll drop to Band C, where you've got essential services like public transport, essential infrastructure maintenance, etc. Then it goes Band B, Band A, where you've got ultimately, with the most restrictions, we still want uncapped ability on life supporting services, emergency services, corrections, hospitals, etc. So there's a really pragmatic plan that's, you know, being published. The phase 3 and 4 are still being worked on because we want to make sure we get that right. And obviously they'll be constantly assessing if we go into phase 2, can we drop back into phase 1, and, you know, similar across all those phases. So yeah, it's quite a dynamic situation, as you've seen. A lot of it beyond our control, and in Australia in the same position. In fact, I heard this morning they're actually sort of replicating similar to our 4-phase response. And then obviously, you know, we're looking at where the most vulnerable are affected, how we can support them with temporary, targeted and timely response, which we talked about last week. So pretty dynamic situation. But unfortunately, we've just got to take one step at a time with it.
The government has repeatedly kind of emphasised that they're not worried about how this crisis is going to go. But with experts forecasting that maybe the crisis will continue to get worse, and especially with New Zealand households, you know, really feeling it in their pockets, is this plan going to really see that get better for New Zealanders, or is there more support to come?
I think there is more support to come, and the plan will work. I mean, it's a dynamic plan, and you can see it's sort of a step change. Like, if the crisis deepens and we respond accordingly, and we've got to protect those valuable services as we go through that process. But the government's also working, you know, hard at a whole range of options. So more fuel supply, more diversification in terms of the fuel we can get into the country, even if it means temporary lowering the standards. Because we know that the Strait of Hormuz has 20% of the world's supply, but there's also 80% still flowing. And so our Prime Minister is having strong talks with, you know, our allies in Singapore, Australia, I think it's Malaysia, and some of those other countries where we've got, you know, bilateral relationships and agreements in within the Pacific region. So we've got to work collectively as well, so we can keep just all optionality open. In diversification, especially in these times, so it's not just it's not a reactive response. There's a lot of proactivity happening across government. So I think certainly New Zealand can feel comforted that we're actively engaging and tackling this head on.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton on the government surcharge ban, their amendments to policing, and the ongoing fuel crisis response.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
That was Front Row Seat by Office Dog. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Last week, Minister for Conservation, Tama Potoka, announced an update on the predator-free 2050 strategy, which aims to rid New Zealand of rats, possums and stoats. $5.5 million of funding was set aside with the aim of making Wellington the first predator-free city in New Zealand within the next 10 years. I spoke to James Russell, Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, about the progress and impact of predator-free projects in Wellington and nationwide. We heard an update from the Conservation Minister, Tama Potoka, that Wellington would be receiving $5.5 million as part of their predator-free campaign. What makes Wellington special and poised to be New Zealand's first predator-free city?
That's a good question. I think to some extent Wellington's just lucky in that it got some runs on the board early. We had Zealandia, originally the Karori Wildlife Sanctuary, established there. It was our first urban predator-proof fenced mainland island, and that was really when we started to be able to show people that a lot of this wildlife restoration isn't something that has to happen on faraway islands or in the so-called backcountry, like the middle of the South Island. It can actually happen in the downtown of a city. As I always say, these birds and reptiles we're trying to save, their preferred habitat is just not being eaten alive. They don't mind whether they're nesting in a pine tree or in someone's house, as long as they've got no rats or stoats or possums eating them. They really live their best life. And then going on from that, with the predator-free New Zealand announcement in 2016, predator-free Midamar, the peninsula that the airport's on, was another of the early projects there. So again, that was taking this idea of, can we remove or eliminate, if you like, is a term we use now, the rats and stoats and possums, but without having to put the fence up. Those fences are quite obtrusive. You know, people don't like seeing a big fence. They're quite expensive, and they also have a limited lifespan. After 20 or 30 years, you have to build them again. If a tree falls down, the fence gets damaged. So could we actually use some of these landforms like peninsulas to set up a predator-free area? And Midamar really demonstrated that. So I think Wellington's really poised to go on this, but we've also had predator-free Dunedin and have got possums off their peninsula recently. But I think it's fair to say the other advantage that Wellington has is it's the politician's backyard. So, and I'm not going to be cynical about that. It's obviously where politicians are and get to see the benefits. But obviously, that's important that politicians get to see the benefits themselves, and so they can reinvest in the predator-free movement.
And what is predator-free Wellington going to look like? And what sort of practical steps being taken to reach it? Because they're trying to do it in 10 years, is it?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Aiming for it in the short term as a pathway to predator-free New Zealand, and demonstrating that we can do the predator-free elimination at an urban landscape level. So zero invasive predators has been leading predator elimination in South Westland across rural landscapes. So that includes backcountry, forest area, farmland, and also some urban areas, but very much in that rural landscape, whereas predator-free Wellington will be doing it right in the middle of a city with all the urban infrastructure there. So what it will look like at first is just doing what we call knockdown, which is trying to take out as many of the pests as possible using conventional tools. But then, as any expert in eradication knows, it's the last 1% of individuals can take 90% of the time to catch. So we sometimes have to, we have to double or triple down there, and we use sometimes what's called a change of method. So we change methods from, say, traps that work well at high density, and then we have to use some very specific methods to find these last survivors. But as we go along this pathway, and what's interesting about predator-free New Zealand is that this pathway is, instead of just seeing eradication as a one-off event that happens at a point in time, seeing if we can transition through these different steps to achieve that elimination. And then as we move towards that elimination and catching the very last individuals, there probably will always be individuals sneaking back in. They'll come in on all kinds of ways. They could come in on cars, vehicles, dump trucks. They might come in on ferries. They might even come in on a plane. They could just walk around boundaries and borders. So when we say predator freedom and elimination, that's not to say that there's not a single individual left. It just means that any individuals that pop up, we eliminate, just as we were doing when we were stamping out COVID, when it started to pop up around our community during the pandemic. So we're looking at maintaining this predator elimination status. And then the benefits of that, the biodiversity outcomes that follow, we'll start to see some of of these rarer birds. We see the fantail, piwaka waka, and the New Zealand wood pigeon, the kereru. They increase in numbers, but then we start to see some of the rarer birds that were previously not there come back. The kararea, the New Zealand falcon, had a comeback that kind of started around the pandemic in Wellington. And then if we're really lucky, what we would hope to see is the tutuwai, the New Zealand robin, and the tiakea, the North Island saddleback. They can spread out of the Zealandia sanctuary into the wider areas of Wellington, where at the moment they quickly get munched by rats or stoats.
What lessons can we learn from the whole Wellington story? How can the policies implemented there be expanded to other cities across the country?
What we're hoping, and some scientists around the Motu have done some great studies showing how do you get the relative balance of predator control and reforestation. So you do need to have some forest for food sources and such for them. So we can look at rolling out some of those lessons from Wellington across other countries. Like Auckland could be really well placed to be a predator-free city. It's got two lovely harbours and a really narrow isthmus, which really is a great bottleneck for catching these predators as they disperse without having to use a fence. And then we've got the two lovely ranges of the Hinua and the Waitakere's, which are places where we could really get some bird numbers back in larger numbers. So there, and then expanding predator-free Dunedin and then working up Northland, we can see there's the narrow isthmus up there is just an area we could work down or up, if you will, to remove these predators. So really, what predator-free Wellington's going to hope to show over the time frame is that it can be done once there, and then we can remodel that elsewhere and really start to put the puzzle pieces of a predator-free New Zealand together. And so we're all working in our own backyard, hometowns and reserves, but if we look up, everyone else is doing it elsewhere.
About putting those pieces together, how are we tracking nationally towards this big project of predator-free 2050? Is it sort of realistic, that time frame? And
I think it's on track. I don't dwell too much personally on the time frame. It's not like a university assignment where if you don't get it in, you... I don't think it should be like a university assignment where if you don't get it in, you fail. You know, if we only did it by 2055, I think I'd accept that as a late assignment. Maybe we'll get ahead of the curve and do it by 2045. I think we're tracking in the right direction is the key thing. And the new predator-free strategy that was launched at the same time has kind of emphasised that. There's kind of four themes there, which is mobilisation, ratcheting in the gains, and that's a really key one. That's making sure that when we do create a predator-free area, we don't lose it if the funding stops, so we don't want to go backwards anywhere. So make sure that once we've got it, we've locked it in, and then we can mobilise people, communities, but also iwi, and then accelerate towards the predator-free goal of New Zealand. So I think that's what we're seeing with predator-free South Westland, 100,000 hectares that are largely eliminated of rats, stoats and possums now, and then predator-free Wellington will add 18,500 hectares, and then hopefully we'll see more of these projects, which many are already going away. Predator-free Dunedin, predator-free Banks Peninsula, Taranaki, Monga, many more, which I haven't been able to give a shout out to here. Mm-hmm. All of them are doing their part.
Do you think there is enough support for all these different predator-free projects from the government? Is there enough funding for it?
I think more funding is always helpful. It will help us get there faster, but we also don't want to move so fast that if we have a global shock or surprise like a pandemic or an oil crisis, mm-hmm. that we don't have the funding redirected. And again, we lose those gains. We haven't locked them in. Mm-hmm. So we want to be moving at the right speed. And I think with the current government, we've seen a lot of shuffling of finances and around portfolios, not just within conservation, but also among education, law and order, and health and so on. So we need to make sure that we generate the funding to keep predator-free New Zealand going, but we also have to make sure it's not just seen as a what you could consider a welfare regime. We need to make sure that the gains from predator-free New Zealand can become self-funding through opportunities such as tourism and perhaps some of the carbon gains that eliminating possums from the landscape creates, and that creates money which we can reinvest to basically self-fund the predator-free movement.
Do you think we will see a predator-free Wellington and Auckland in the near future? And what do you think that would look and sound like?
If it's I try to proudly keep my own backyard in the Waitakere Ranges predator-free, and I can tell you what it sounds like. It sounds louder than you think at 4 a.m. in the morning when the tui start calling, but it's a good wake-up alarm. And so that's basically, you get the return of the dawn chorus. In fact, the dawn chorus almost stops being a dawn chorus. When you go out to some of our most treasured islands, Hauturu Otoi, Little Barrier Island, and others, there is no dawn chorus. There's just chorus all the time of birds singing. So that's what I'm looking forward to. And I think, if we keep working at it, it is realistic, and we'll get there, and we'll just keep adding these pieces together.
That was the University of Auckland's Professor James Russell speaking about recent changes to the predator-free 2050 strategy and efforts to make Wellington New Zealand's first predator-free city.
That was The Green World.
Kia ora. RNZ recently conducted an investigation into sales of illicit tobacco in Aotearoa, New Zealand, finding an increasing sale throughout the country. The investigation described illicit tobacco as an open secret, with many dairies now stocking and importing cigarettes, and indicated an increase in both supply and demand. The economical effect has been felt by those not engaging in the illegal trade, as general turnover in cigarettes has decreased. Professor Chris Bullen, Professor of Public Health in the Department of General Practice and Primary Care at the School of Population Health of the University of Auckland, has refuted the claims made in the RNZ investigation, and I spoke to him about his research into the illegal tobacco market. Yeah, you had said that the research contradicts this RNZ investigation regarding the sales of illicit tobacco. What is that research and how does it contradict that investigation?
Well, the research that we've been undertaking for the last 3 years is funded by the Ministry of Health, and it's all about monitoring the illicit trade in tobacco. And so we do this in a number of ways to try and get a what we call triangulation. So because illicit activity is by definition undercover, it's really hard to get a handle on what's happening with it. And so we use a number of different sources of information to try and get the best idea of whether things are getting worse or better or staying the same. Well, I'm not saying there isn't illicit tobacco trading going on and that there aren't shops selling black market tobacco. I know there are, for sure. I see illegal packs on my journey to work every day, so we know it's out there. The question really is it getting a whole lot worse? And one of the problems with taking, for example, customs interceptions at the border as the measure of whether things are getting worse or not is that customs probably getting better at detecting, so that's not necessarily meaning that there's more coming across, so they might be just picking up more. And then secondly, we're not picking up a signal from social media sales and like Facebook Marketplace and various other language-specific websites. We're not seeing a big spike in traffic there. And we haven't seen an increase in the data produced by the Ministry of Health in what people who smoke in New Zealand report smoking. In fact, generally smoking and cigarette sales are going down. So we expect the demand for both legal and illicit tobacco to be dropping as smoking becomes less popular. So for those reasons, I'm not saying there isn't a problem, nor am I saying that it couldn't get worse, because it could. But right now, and looking over the last 3 years, we don't believe there's been dramatic shift in this illicit tobacco trade.
As you mentioned, the fact that customs is intercepting more could show that they're getting better at it. On the other hand, it could also mean that, say, if customs are maintaining the same strategies and the fact that they're picking up more could also mean there is more coming in. What does make you believe that customs are getting better at intercepting?
Well, they've been resourced in the last couple of years to have a specific unit, people focused particularly on black market tobacco. And so we know that they've put more money into it and more people at it. And as time goes by, they get more information on where to look, what sources, country sources of origin, kinds of goods that are claimed to be imported, and like whiteware appliances, that sort of thing. So I think, I'm not saying the volumes aren't going up as well, but I think there's good reason to suspect that they're getting better at their job, looking for illicit tobacco as they are with other things. And so that's one part of the equation. And the other part is, their sales from local dairies. Well, the government's invested in more smoke reinforcement officers in the last 12 months. So we'd expect more activity in terms of picking up illicit sales, or they should be getting better at it. Or clearly they're not covering everywhere because people are still able to buy their cigarettes illicitly. But we've also done some surveys of people who smoke and asked them would they be prepared to purchase illegal tobacco, and a proportion of people are. But there are people who smoke who don't want to have anything to do with dodgy sources of cigarettes. Not completely a straightforward situation.
Do you think it's possible that these criminal enterprises have adapted new methods to maybe avoid detection through traditional methods?
Sure. Of course, they're always going to do that. So So it's a valid point. You know, they're very clever of it, just like any other illegal market. They flex and adapt and use new ways of communicating that they've got products for sale. So that's what we'd expect. So that's one of the reasons for monitoring, you know, websites and so forth, and trying to keep up to play with terms that are code language that's used by people for selling products, for example. But until the return on investment becomes worthwhile, you know, penalties if you are caught, then you know, you're not going to see a lot of interest from criminal gangs if they can make more money out of you know, MDMA and methamphetamine and cocaine and so forth.
Yeah, in that sense, obviously, because New Zealand does have very high prices on tobacco, perhaps these importers, the gains that they can make, let's say, on a single pack of cigarettes would be significantly higher in Australia and New Zealand, I guess, especially than anywhere else. Could that potentially incentivize these criminal enterprises?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, they do their maths and they figure out, you know, where the most money's to be made for the effort and risk investment. And so tobacco has been until recently a relatively low risk, but if you get caught selling illicit tobacco, the fines have gone up substantially. So I think probably going to be a constant adaptation and recalibration of the risk reward, you know, calculation that these guys do. Anyway, all I'm saying is that the current monitoring does not suggest that things have got as bad as they are anywhere near Australia, for example. And part of that is probably Australia's proximity to the Asian market and ease of getting things through their border. New Zealand's a whole other, you know, leg of the journey further. Smaller market as well. So I would say they're directing most of their efforts in bigger marketplaces like Australia.
That was the University of Auckland's Professor Chris Bullen about the illicit tobacco trade in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ohotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Professor Alan Blackman, National MP Ryan Hamilton, and the University of Auckland's James Russell and Chris Bullum.
Nei I rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got The Wonder Four with Joel.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.